We did every single thing together when we were growing up. We get the same clothes, same shoes, same haircut. We play together, we work together, we do everything together. If there was any safer option, I would never ever spend the amount of money I spend on him to go through that dangerous journey. I wouldn't even want it in my worst enemy. But it's dying in the prison that they were in, or you're gonna die trying to cross as well. So it's one or the other, and there's nothing in between. You have to try. I did feel guilty in a way that I'm might be supporting him to lose his life. When he's so attached to his brother, and you find out he's lost, when I heard his voice, I was like, thank God. I was like, now I've been to church. And I left it to God, and he made it happen.
Welcome back to Asylum Speakers. I'm your host, Jazz O'Hara, and together with some very special guests, we'll be taking you on a journey across the world without you having to go anywhere. We're here to amplify voices, to educate, inspire, and debunk some of the common myths and misconceptions around migration today. So join us as we transcend borders, nationalities, religions, and languages to hear from the people with which we share this world, celebrating our differences and recognizing what unites us. Listen out for yourself in the words of each guest, because at the end of the day, we're all human and always able to find common ground should we choose to. This episode is brought to you by Skin and Me, a personalized skincare solution that has not only transformed my skin, but also my packing experience wherever I'm going. Skin and Me's tailored treatment is designed specifically to meet your personal skin concerns, from acne to pigmentation to signs of aging and more. You have an online consultation, you send some pictures of your skin, and you get your treatment made to order, shipped directly to you in a monthly daily doser. The Daily Doser dispenses exactly how much cream you need each day, meaning no wasted product, you never run out, and it even has your name inscribed in it. I've personally used the product for the last few months, and I've seen a significant difference in my skin since doing so, and it's now the only product that I take with me when I travel. The best part is that it's normally $24.99 per month, but you can get your first month for just £3.50 with the code ASYLUMSPEAKERS, all in one word and all capitals, for an over 85% discount on your first month. Welcome back to the podcast. This is an episode and a story that I have been wanting to share for nearly 2 years. I actually had a version of this episode ready to release about a year and a half ago, but as there has been an ongoing legal case involved, I was advised not to publish it. And guys, I honestly don't think that I've ever cared so much about the outcome of a legal case. So obviously I didn't want to do anything to compromise or jeopardize that. But I am so happy, I could not be more happy to finally share this story with you, and that this nightmare journey, it makes me emotional thinking about it. This nightmare journey has finally come to an end, and another much more exciting journey is about to start. So let me explain from the beginning. This episode is about my Eritrean brother Mez and his younger brother Yesif. Most of you already know Mez, as he's been a guest on the podcast a couple of times before, sharing his story of how he crossed the Sahara Desert, the Mediterranean Sea, how he lived in the Calais jungle and hid underneath the Eurotunnel train to make it to the UK. He talked about that journey in episode 5. And in episode 6, he talks about life since he made it here and what that has looked like, learning English, going to school, navigating the asylum system, integrating into a new family and a new life where everything was new and different. So if you haven't listened to those two episodes, I would really recommend them. They're two of the most popular episodes ever. And Mez shares so beautifully about his experiences. He's an amazing speaker. We actually give a lot of talks in schools and at events and things. And especially recently with the book launch, we've done quite a lot of events together. So if you know anyone or anywhere who might benefit from hearing his story firsthand, then definitely get in contact. Anyway, I'm digressing. Back to the story. So I've also recorded a couple of episodes over the years with my mum and dad, and they both have spoken about being foster parents to four boys from four different countries. And in the episode with my dad, some of you might remember that we talk a little bit about some of the difficulties, such as how painful it's been for all of us to watch Mez navigate this situation with his little brother. But other than that, I've never really shared the full story in a podcast episode, partly because it's all felt so close to home and just too raw whilst in the midst of it all, but also because of the legal case. So basically, a few years after Mez left Eritrea to avoid compulsory military service, so too did his little brother Yesif, who we actually call Josie for short. So Josie is 2 years younger than Mez, and they grew up doing everything together. They wore the same clothes, they liked all the same things, and Mez described him as being his little shadow. So despite Mez's warnings of how dangerous it was, it's no wonder that when he also became of age to be called up to the military, Josie chose to follow in his older brother's footsteps and flee the dictatorship in which he lived, in the hope of joining his older brother here in the UK. Unfortunately, since Mez made this 9-month journey, things have only got harder, and Josie has spent the last 4 years on this journey. Most of that time, he's been trapped in Libya, trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to make it to the safety of Europe. He has attempted the sea crossing 4 times, been captured by the Libyan Coast Guard 4 times, thrown into Libyan smuggler prison, and suffered the unimaginable horrors that come with that. Beatings, torture, modern-day slavery, starvation. I cannot begin to imagine or explain what he has suffered. But I do know the impact that this has had on Mez. I've watched it eat away at him day by day, month by month, year by year. I've watched him lose weight, lose sleep, and lose his sparkle as he's done his best to keep his brother alive, to keep his mum in Eritrea informed and calm, and to do everything in his power to pursue what seemed impossible, finding a safe and legal way to get his brother here to safety. So first of all, let's go back in time a little bit to when I sat down with my mum back in January of last year to have a catch up on a few things, including where we were at with Mez's brother. This is a piece of an interview that I never shared because of the case, but I'm so happy that I actually can now. Mama, how are you doing?
Hey, Jazz.
Hello.
I'm good because it's so nice to have you home for a few weeks. It's so lovely.
I'm loving it too. I literally never want to leave. It's I keep really saying cozy. To everyone that it's just really nice for me to be here spending some time together with everybody.
Yeah, lovely.
Driving with Beej. He's learning and doing really well. I love driving with him. Although I'm not a very good teacher, but I think he's trying.
You're probably a nervous wreck rather than a good teacher.
Oh, Bijo's here.
Bijo! Where did you come from, my darling? I didn't know you were home.
Mum keeps saying, I wonder when Bijo's coming home.
Oh.
Are you sleeping?
Doing my homework.
We thought you were out.
I said to Jess, well, when's Bijo going to come home? He's eating with us tonight.
No, it's done. What are you cooking?
So Jess and I are
quite
a little
hungry as well.
Eh?
I'm quite hungry as well, actually.
Well, I might be eating at 7.
Okay.
Okay.
Sounds good.
I make some nice wraps. Chicken for you.
Chicken wrap?
Yeah. Is that nice?
Sounds good.
We're going to do a bit of recording and then we'll eat at 7, yeah?
All right. Enjoy.
Okay.
Seven-ish.
Okay, Mama. I'm so happy to have you back on the podcast. You're my favourite guest.
Thank you.
I shouldn't say that, should I?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm always a bit reluctant to be on a podcast because I feel like I've got nothing to say.
Well, I know that that's not true because
I'm suffering from imposter syndrome.
The last 2 episodes that we've done together, people have really enjoyed and people love to listen to you. So We actually just heard today that someone had heard your episode listened to your episode.
Yeah. It was nice to hear. It's nice to hear when people actually did listen and did like it.
Mm.
Because I always think, you know, my story is not that interesting. Well, but yeah, here I am. You persuaded me.
I beg to differ. And we've got some things to catch up on today because it's been a little while since you were last here. And one of the things I'd love to talk about is a funny story that you told me since I've been home about when you bumped into a Syrian friend in the halal shop in our local town.
I'm laughing and I'm feeling embarrassed by the memory of it. Yeah, it's so interesting with language. So when people speak a second language, which I do as well, obviously, but you can get little things so wrong and then you can get confusion. So this thing that happened was I was in the shop, the halal shop with our youngest, Z. And we met this Syrian man there who we know. So I said hi to him and he showed me a picture of his baby. And the baby looked adorable in a little dressing gown and really lovely. So we had a little chat and then we'd done our shopping and off we went. Me and Z, we were leaving the shop. And as we were leaving, I said to the man, nice to see you, Ali. And I love your baby. Right? And to me, it was just an innocent remark, but we walked out and Z said, oh my God, Mom, you're so embarrassing. I said, why? Because she said, I love you, baby. I said, no, I didn't say that. I said, I love your baby. That's different. One letter difference, but it's different, you know. But as you said, I thought, did he think I said that? That's so embarrassing. I would never say, I love you, baby.
You were just shouting, I love you, baby, as you left.
Yeah. No, I didn't say that. But yeah, we did laugh afterwards when I explained to him that, no, I didn't actually say that.
I thought that was such a good story. And we actually went to visit that baby this morning, didn't we? And I actually got to hold him in real life. And he is
adorable.
Gorgeous.
And I love babies. So, and they know that. So that's why he showed me the cute picture. But yeah, sometimes we have little misunderstandings like that. So similar. It's just one letter, the difference.
Have there been any other examples of language learning or funny moments that you can think of recently? Being home, I always enjoy seeing the development and progress of the boys and their language. It's really nice
to see how they're learning, how fast they're learning. And it's really satisfying to hear them learning the language and using like funny sayings in the right way. Like, I wasn't born yesterday. And I think, wow, he used that in the right way. Fantastic, you know. And the youngest one is now, after being in England only, well, less than 2 years, he's now doing GCSEs and we're working on Macbeth and Inspector Calls. So I've been studying it as well to be able to explain it to him. And yeah, it's been fun because it's quite complicated, really, if you think about it, if it's your second language.
Especially Macbeth, when it's old English, that is completely different from the way that we speak now.
Very different. But fortunately, these days, we have lots of lovely little videos on YouTube.
They can explain it.
Yeah, they've been a lifesaver. So I lie in bed early in the morning watching little videos so I can tell him, you know.
To explain Macbeth in a simple way.
Yeah.
And there's a film of Inspector Calls as well.
Yeah, it's very good, actually. I really enjoyed it.
I haven't watched it and I didn't do the book for GCSE either, but I definitely got the gist of the story of kind of morality. And we talked about it a lot over dinner, didn't we? Like, who was to blame? And
well, it's very much about taking responsibility for people around you and not just washing your hands off things, but taking responsibility. I really like it, actually. I never realized how much I actually like that story. You can't just blame everyone else when something horrible happens. We all are having responsibility for people around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that if you see something happening that's not right, are you also doing something wrong by not saying something?
Exactly. And we often are in that situation because I think we live in a society where we are taught not to interfere. We're very scared of interfering. The boys actually come often from cultures and societies where people do interfere more. And sometimes I think that's quite good because they take responsibility and they look after each other. And I notice it that they are often the first ones to stand up for people if they're being bullied or if something horrible happens. And I'm very proud of that. They do that.
equally, I have to stand up for them sometimes, and I notice I don't always find that easy because I don't want to be a pain. I don't want to phone to school again. I don't want to be like that, but I have to do it. That's what I feel my job is, to speak up for them. I don't find it always easy.
Definitely. And, you know, there are things that happen. You told me the story recently, or actually Z told me the story that one of the teachers said something to him that definitely triggered me. And I'd love to speak to this teacher. I don't know if you want to tell it now.
Yeah, people say they're sort of offhand remarks and they don't always realize how painful those remarks are. Like what happened was Z came back in class from having been outside and he said, oh, the weather is miserable. And she said, well, you chose to come here.
You chose to come to this country.
Yeah, you chose to come to this country. And she said it another time afterwards. And he said then, I actually didn't choose to come here. It wasn't a choice. I had to. And I thought, wow, does that lady not realize what these kids go through? Probably not. So maybe she should listen to the podcast.
Yeah, I hope she is. Because, yeah, I guess that comes from a naivety, to put it nicely, or a...
Ignorance,
yes, to put it not as nicely. And a lack of understanding and knowledge of what he's actually been through to get here, right?
Well, ignorance is just not knowing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And we are all ignorant until we know. Mm-hmm. I was ignorant a few years ago. And now I know a lot more. And now I hear a comment like that and I think, oh, wow, it hurts me when I hear that. Mm. Painful.
Absolutely. Mum, one thing that lots of people have been asking me about is for a little bit of an update on Mez's brother. Do you think you could tell us what's been going on in the last few months?
Well, miracles do happen. I believe in miracles. And I've always said to Mez that she'd never lose hope because anything can happen. Mezra's brother was in a difficult situation. He was trying to get here as well. And he still is trying to get here. And then for months, we didn't hear from him. Mez didn't hear from him. And he was really worried. You know, the worry is always that he might be dead. He might be drowned. And that's a real worry.
Because the last we heard of him before Mez didn't hear for a few months was that he was about to cross the sea from Libya to Italy, right? Which we all know is super, super dangerous.
Super dangerous. So dangerous.
Impossible to do.
And even though Mez told him not to do it, I mean, he's just determined to get out of Libya because it was difficult for him there. Very difficult. And that's probably an understatement. So then we didn't hear from him for months. And yeah, I could see that Mez was really suffering. And I said to him, well, don't lose hope yet, you know, incredible things can happen. And I put a bed in his room and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm manifesting him coming over. So I'm making a bed and I imagine your brother sleeping in it. And then before we knew it, we got a phone call from a man who said, hey, Mezret, I was in prison with your brother. He's in prison in Libya and he's okay, but he can't get into contact with you right now. But if you give him money, then you can get him out of prison, which is what Mezret did. But also that same week, somehow, we made contact with a lawyer who at first said she was full, but then said, okay, I'll take on this case. And she's working really hard now to try to get him over here. So that would be fantastic if that happened. And we're all keeping our fingers crossed that, that is going to happen. And we didn't even know, well, I didn't know that there was a possibility of him coming here legally because I thought it was only possible if it was like a parent who wants their children here.
Mm. Well, technically it is only possible. And, you know, we've been told before that you couldn't apply for family reunification for your brother. Mm. And, you know, that's why this lawyer has to put together this really comprehensive case of all of the reasons as to why Mez needs his brother here and the implications or repercussions it's having on Mez to have to deal with the stress of his brother being
and
on this journey.
Massive repercussions. It's been very hard for him. But it's really exciting that this lovely lady came into our lives and somehow knows what to do and she's doing it. She's helping us and it's great.
She's given us hope of another way that doesn't involve him risking his life and a way that we didn't know was possible.
No.
So we're very, very grateful for that and thankful. And You know, it could take months and it could take refusals from the Home Office and appeals, but we're just going to keep going until he's here with us. Right?
At least something is happening. Something is happening. You know, it's a positive thing.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. Mum, can you think of anything else that you want to talk about?
The boys now all have travel papers, so we're going on holiday together in the summer. Can't wait.
I can't wait for that.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
All 12 of us, or however many there is all together, on holiday in another country. First time that that's happened ever.
It's going to be amazing.
Really, really excited for that too. I can't wait. Cool. All right, Mum, should we have some dinner?
Yeah, lovely. Let's do it.
So we went on that family holiday in the summer of 2022. Month after month passed and things were still going very slowly with the case. During those long and painful months of waiting, I sat down with Mayors to hear how he was feeling about everything. I started by asking him to go back in time to when his brother had first left their home country of Eritrea and recently arrived in Libya with high hopes of crossing the Mediterranean Sea and joining us here in Europe.
I was feeling excited at first, very excited because some boat was coming in. I started following the MSF. They were rescuing a lot of people from the Mediterranean Sea. So I was like, maybe we can get saved and get out from Libya. That was the main aim.
So what was the situation then? That you, to just explain what you were waiting for, basically, like where he was at.
The first time he tried, then they got caught and sent back. But the second time, they were guaranteed that they would be going and then be rescued. So they were literally guaranteed. So I paid more money for that and he was on his way to go. So I was optimistic, but I was like, okay, it might happen. So he told me like, oh, we can might be going in one of these days, like today or tomorrow. I was like, okay, cool, cool. I'll give you the phone number for the MSF. He gave me a number from the hotline. Alarm phone. And I gave him that number, so he wrote it down in a paper and put it in a plastic and stuff, so if anything happens, they can still use it. But I didn't hear anything from him for like 3-4 days, and I started to get worried. And then I was like, I might just call the smugglers and see if they know anything. Called them, didn't answer at all. They answered once. Then they're like, no, we don't know where they are, or they might be saved, so you need to wait and we'll let you know. And I was like, I can't wait. And then all of a sudden, one guy called me from Germany, said, oh, my brother was with your brother. My brother got rescued and then he's in Malta now. But I think they rejected. They caught the other boat that had been sent after them, and I think it's been caught by the Libyan police. I was like, no way. That can't happen, because they said, there's no one going to catch you. You're going to go straight in, because we paid them a lot of money or something like that. And then the day go past, I was like, oh, God, it happened. And I could not get any contact from anyone. That was my main issue. There's a guy that either in Italy or Germany, he does a lot of work with the people in Libya. So I contacted him and said, do you know anything about the boats been gone for the past few days? He's like, there's hundreds of boats going every day. Mm. I cannot tell you when what boat he was or where he is. I was like, that's crazy, because I thought they weren't sending that many boats, because there's no one rescuing them. But they were trying every single day. One smuggler would send at least 10 boats every night. And some of them get caught and sent back. Some of them go somewhere. Some of them die. Yeah, you just take your chance.
Mez is talking about one attempt that his brother made to cross the sea. The last that Mez had heard was that he was about to cross, and then he heard nothing for a very long time.
And then just it carried on. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to contact. Can't contact my brother. Can't contact the smugglers. And then I went to Red Cross. And they were like, we only deal with people that are actually missing and like where they are. Like if they are missing in the UK or something, we can put a contact. We can get some contacts and maybe we'll let you know if we can find something. But, you know, long waiting list. So we can't give you any answers right now. So they didn't come back to me at all after that. And I was dead worried. Like I couldn't tell my mom. I couldn't tell my brothers. I was only telling you or mum in here. And my parents was calling me all the time saying, how is he? Where is he? How's he doing? Give us a call with him so we know he's safe. I was like, yeah, he's okay. He's okay. He's okay. But I was lying because I don't even know where he is.
Mez had to lie to his Eritrean mum to keep her calm, pretending that he had heard from little Yesif and that he was safe, when in reality he hadn't heard anything from him and he didn't even know whether he was alive.
I tell them like, yeah, I just spoke to him yesterday. So I put their mind in rest and saying like, okay, he's fine, but he's actually not because I don't know where he is. Weeks go by and then it becomes 2 months. Then he was gone for at least 2-3 months and I could not deal with it. I was just so stressed and I couldn't sleep properly.
Mez coped with his emotion by distracting himself with work.
Just keep working, working, working the whole time. I start 7 o'clock in the morning, finish 12 o'clock. So I don't get distracted about or thinking about it all the time. Then as soon as I go home, then I'll be very tired. So I'll just try to go to sleep, but can't really sleep anyway. I'll go to Facebook, try to find any boat that has been captured. Couldn't find anything. So I was very, very worried and I didn't know what to do. It's very hard not to know what to do. I was thinking of going to Libya myself. So I tried to find something there. Well, I can't do that because there was a lot of stuff that was happening there as well. They just captured over 5,000 refugees, tried to put them in prison. So even if I go there myself, I can't do anything because I don't speak Arabic or don't know where I am, don't know what to do. So I was worried a lot. Didn't know what to do. So I was just, okay, I'll just wait and see what happens.
So the last that you'd heard from him, he was about to cross the sea and you'd sent him the money to do that. Did you feel guilty in any way or did you know that you'd done what he wanted?
I did feel guilty in a way that I might be supporting him to lose his life, but I don't want to hold him from what he wants to do as well because that's the only way that he wants to get across because there's nowhere else. If there was any safer option, I would never ever spend the amount of money I spend on him to go through that dangerous journey. I wouldn't even want it in my worst enemy. But he wanted to do it and he wanted to try his luck. So I can't hold him and put him in prison because I feel terrible doing that as well. It's dying in the prison that they were in, or you're going to die trying to cross as well. So it's one or the other. So instead of sitting down and feel sorry for yourself all the time, or you can just try and see what happens. It did make me feel shit, but he wanted to try. So I was like, okay, I'll let you do your thing. You don't want to be the one that's left there. And you can't be left there because you have to pay and you have to try. There's nothing in between it. Like you can't just sit there and then wait. Because if you don't pay, they will sell you to someone else. And if you don't try, they will just get rid of you.
Wait, let me just repeat what you said. If you don't pay, they will sell you.
Yeah.
So in 2021, basically people were being bought and sold in Libya.
Absolutely. They will sell you to some horrible smuggler and then he will make you pay, regardless if you want to pay or not. So
there's no way that you can like live a safe life in Libya, basically?
It's not a country for refugees. It might be safe for the people that are from Libya, but for us, it's living in hell.
Mez went on to explain about life in Libya for an East African asylum seeker. Many people from Sudan and Eritrea travel north to Libya in the hope of crossing from there to Europe. Everybody that I have ever spoken to who has done so has described Libya as hell on earth. A place where it's barely possible to even walk down the street without fear of being stopped, questioned, beaten, captured, imprisoned or enslaved. A place where you are seen as a commodity, bought, sold, held at ransom and tortured whilst your family members listen over the phone until they send money for your release.
Can't leave there. It doesn't have any government or it doesn't have anything that support the people that come into the country or the public there. So it's just very unsafe country.
And the things that happen to refugees there that we've read and that you've experienced, right, are like super, super horrible.
Yeah. If you try to do anything, either you get killed or you get bitten really badly. So you don't get washed. You don't eat that much food. You eat like once a day or something. Yeah, it's very horrible people. They used to put us 800 people in one basement or something. And I've told you this before, but like, you can't sleep lying down. Some of us would lie down for a little bit and then some of them would stand and then we swap. So some of us can lie down, some of us can sleep and some of us stand up or something. Well, yeah. It's not a good place for a refugee, especially for underage.
So after months of hearing nothing and fearing the worst, Mez got a phone call one evening whilst he was working a shift as a food delivery driver.
One night, I was working, it was Saturday evening, was working and then I got a phone call from Libya. I answered it so quickly. I never answered a call that quickly. I answered it and then I was like, hey, who is this? And he's like, I'm your brother's friend. Your brother was with me in prison and we were lost for a long time. So he gave me your number to call you and tell you where he is. And he's okay, but he was the youngest in the people that we were in the prison. And he's not in a good place at all. Is really struggling, ill, stuff like that. So I'll give you a phone number and then you can contact that guy and pay 700 and get him out. And I was like, yeah, just give me the phone number. I don't care if it's 700 or 1 million. I just want to get my brother out. So he gave me that phone number and I called the guy straight away. I even have order to do, but I just did the delivery so quickly, paused my shift, and I was like trying to make that happen. So I called the guy straight away and he's like, yeah, don't worry about it. It's no problem. He's like, yeah, I'll give you this account and then you send the money, I'll get your brother out. He's so rude at first. I wouldn't ask him how my brother is or if I can speak to my brother, if he's alive or not. Because they do that sometimes. They just say, oh, your brother is in this place. Give us this money. We get him out. Then you give them the money. They don't get your brother out. They just take the money. But I couldn't care. As long as he can find my brother, So I had to send him a picture of my brother, a name, and all the money he asked for. And then he went there. He called me and he said, is this your brother? And I was like, yes, he is.
So he put you on the phone to your brother?
Yeah, he said, is this your brother? And my brother said, hello, it's me. And then he hung up the phone straight away. Couldn't even say hello, how are you, or where you been. He hung up the phone straight away and then say, okay, I'll take him out from here. And then you do whatever you want to do with him. I was like, I don't know where to put him. I don't know where, like, he doesn't have anywhere to go. So I contacted my older brother in Ethiopia and he said, this one of my friend lives in Libya. I'll contact him and then he might go and get him from the, and he comes out from the prison. I was like, oh, thank God for that.
So Mez paid the money to release his brother from smuggler prison, but then felt the responsibility of finding somewhere for him to go to recover and recuperate from months of living in terrible conditions. The boys have an older brother who lives in Ethiopia, and he had a friend in Libya who put up Yassif and looked after him until he was in better health.
He got out from there, and then one of my brother's friend, he met him and then took him to his house. He helped him with a lot of stuff there and welcomed him so nicely. He put him with him in his room, where the room is like for 6-7 people sharing it, and just one bedroom house, but 6-7 people living in one. So he stayed with them for a little bit. So I sent him another £300 so he can settle in. He bought his clothes, he bought a phone so he can contact me. That's when I told my mom that he's actually safe and sound. Then she was like, I really want to talk to him. I haven't spoken to him in 6-7 months. I want to talk to him. I think you're lying, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I'm not lying. That's when I start saying, I'm not lying. And otherwise, I would say like, no, it's fine. Try to change the conversation as quick as I can so she doesn't think about him. But then I made it happen. I called them and told them he's actually safe. And he called them and said, hi, they're okay now.
Meza's biological parents in Eritrea had also been worried sick about their son. With no means of contacting him or helping his situation, they relied on Mez for news.
Even when they call me, they wouldn't even say, like, they would say, hi, how are you? How's your brother? Where is he? They wouldn't even ask me, like, if I'm doing okay or something like that. I don't mind that, but like, I just couldn't imagine how worried they are. Like, they're just straight away saying, how is he doing? Where is he? And I was like, it's fine. Just taking time.
Miss, when you got that phone call when you were at work and it was a Libyan number and he told you, how did you feel?
I don't think I can relieve the emotion. I was so excited. And so relieved. Like, my body felt lighter for some reason. I feel like I was carrying a lot of weight. I think I was so stressed by it, not even thinking about how stressed I was. I was just keep working. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, I felt like my body is so light that I can move around. And it was crazy. Like, I never thought getting stressed or getting worried can make you that tense. And don't think about anything else but just your work and your brother, stuff like that. So, but when I heard the phone call and he's actually safe, I was like, oh my God. And then I start working again. I worked the whole evening happily. It was crazy evening.
And what about when you spoke to him on the phone and you heard his voice?
Yeah, that made me very, very excited again. And I was like, oh my God. You don't even know how I felt the past 3 months. Can't even think, like, I don't even know how to explain it, you know? When you're so attached to this brother, like, and you find out he's lost, it brings so many memories, and you don't want that to happen again. So when I heard his voice, I was like, thank God. I was like, oh, thank God so much. You know, I've been to church for a while, but like, yeah. I left it to God and he made it happen. But yeah, it brings me so many memories and emotions and did not want it to happen again.
Mez is referring to his own time in Libya. He was there with his best friend Nahom, who he had left Eritrea with and crossed the Sahara with when they were very young. They were separated when Mez got on a boat and was rescued from the Mediterranean by the Italian Coast Guard and taken to Italy. Mez has never heard from his best friend again. No one has. And they fear the worst.
Like how I lost my friend. We did every single thing when we were growing up. If it's a celebration, we get the same clothes, same shoes, same haircut. We do everything, we play together, we work together, we do everything together, and same with my friend. And I see my friend just like as my brother, and we did every single thing together as well. And we left together, and yeah, it's completely gone now. So I don't know where he is. I did not want that to happen to my brother, so I was dead worried.
So these interviews were recorded early last year. Since then, time has stood still for Mez and his brother, whilst Mez's incredible lawyer has worked on their case. DNA tests, proof of financial support, taking the Home Office to court. We've done it all, been through it all. On the 4th of May this year, I was making my way home from South Africa, having been away for a month. Mez and Yesif were on my mind. When my dad picked me up from the station with my suitcase, it was the first thing I asked him. Any news on the case? Nope, he responded. Last I heard, there was a problem with Yesif's DNA test results. They got lost in transit or something, he sighed. I made sure not to ask Mez about it when I got home. As I was unpacking my suitcase that afternoon, my dad called me downstairs. Jazz, get down here. I could hear from his voice that something had happened. I ran down to find Mez standing in the living room, tears pouring down his face. He held his phone up to me to show me an email. It was from the Home Office. We are pleased to inform you that Yesif Bereket has been accepted for family reunification, it read. That's as far as I got. I've never, ever felt anything like it. We hugged and waited impatiently for my mum to finish with her client so that we could tell her. The journey wasn't quite over. Yesif needed to get safely out of Libya and would first be flown to Romania on a UNHCR plane, where he would be held in some kind of facility for a month so they could conduct medical tests and things. We were given a date, Wednesday the 12th of July, and a flight number from Romania to Germany, Germany to London Heathrow. It was up to Mez to pick him up, Mez was told over the phone. I'll be there a week early, said Mez. It was a miracle. Over the years, I've asked you guys several times to keep praying, manifesting, believing that Mez's brother would find a way here. Thank you to everyone who has kept him in their thoughts. Seriously, you know, for us, we have been truly, truly blessed. But for millions of others, most other asylum seekers, in fact, these legal routes or options simply do not exist. Hopefully this episode goes some way in highlighting just how difficult it is to find a legal way. In our next episode, we'll hear what life has been like since Mez and Yesif got the huge life-changing news that Yesif would finally be coming here. What it was like for them to be reunited after 10 years and what Yesif's first days in the UK have felt like. Thank you so much to all of you for being here on this journey with us. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode and what you'd like to hear more of on the show. To get in touch, send me a message on Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it, rate it, and leave a review. It helps more people to find this podcast, and it helps me to keep bringing you these stories. To support the show, check out our Patreon page. The link is in the show notes. Thank you to Ez Stone for mixing this podcast and Alexander Wells for composing the original score. A final thank you to the MSN Fund and to Skin and Me for making this episode possible. As you guys know, I'm very particular about which brands I would work with on this podcast, but Skin and Me's product is sustainable, vegan, cruelty-free, and has really worked for me. Check out skinandme.com and remember to use the code ASYLUMSPEAKERS, all in caps and all one word, for over 85% off your first month.